Welcome to Wildlife Outdoors with your host, Russell and Jose. If you have a passion for conservation of the outdoors, or you're enjoying a calming hike in the mountains, an exhilarating kayak trip on the river, feeling a fish on the end of your line, cooking on an open flame in a primitive campsite, or stalking big game, just waiting for the perfect shot, you're in the right place. So put on your boots and polarized sunglasses and come along for the ride.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another Wildlife Outdoors podcast. My name is Jose, and of course, as always, we're joined by Russell, the host of the podcast, and today should be a good one. Today, we're joined by Rob McConnell, a.k.a. Fly Fishing the Sam on Instagram. If you haven't heard of him or aren't familiar with his work, Rob is an accomplished author, having written two books on the subject of fly fishing, his first being Fly Fishing the Sam, and his most recent release, Fly Fishing Houston in Southeastern Texas. Great books full of knowledge and tips and techniques. Highly recommend checking them out. In addition, Rob is a fantastic fly fisherman, hunter, trapper, and just general outdoorsman. And he is a proud husband and father and a good friend of mine in the podcast. And we hope you enjoy this episode.
It's nice to meet you, man. So I hear that you're quite the author and fisherman, huh?
I would say thanks for both of those compliments, but I don't know if I'm worthy of either of them. Yes, I do enjoy fly fishing, and I've written two books, Fly Fishing the Sam, which was kind of my foray into writing. It was a self-published book, published it in 2020, mm-hmm. During COVID. And just a little book is like 80 pages, something like that. And it was just kind of a guidebook for an area that I've enjoyed exploring, which is Sam Houston National Forest, just north of Houston. And it was just a kind of a pioneering effort, a little bit of like a, you know, kind of wrote it on a whim kind of thing. And and then after that, I wrote, Aaron Reed, the author of Fly Fishing Austin in Central Texas, contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing Fly Fishing Houston in Southeastern Texas. And after thinking about it a little bit, I decided to go for it. And and that was published February of this year. So, and mm-hmm. that was through an actual publisher, you know, through Imberfex Books, the same publisher that did Aaron Reed's book. Uh-huh. So it's, you know, very similar format. Real nice maps, real nice pictures, glossy pages, you know, and that was like a, you know, that took me 2 years to write kind of thing, you know, you know, over 300 pages long. It's like a legit guidebook. So,
that's awesome. I got both books, but, I've only skimmed through the Houston one, I've skimmed through it a little bit, but I mean, being up in Arkansas, they don't do me too much good in terms of locations, but both seem to be good quality stuff. So that's freaking awesome. Now, what got you into writing in the first place?
I just kind of like, you know, I've had journals and stuff like that where I've jotted down, you know, I mean, it's one of those things, right, where it's, you know, just if you keep an outdoor journal, you're never like, you're never sorry about it. You know what I mean? It's, you know, there's been instances where if you're like duck hunting or if you're fishing or something and, you know, you go a whole season and you've just like felt like you did an awesome job that season, or, you know, you killed a bunch of ducks, or you had such a great year fishing, and then you like think back on it the next year and you're like, man, I wish I would have remembered all those spots that I went to. It's just like keeping an outdoor journal. That was kind of like the catalyst for the whole thing. You know, I mean, I've written for small blogs and stuff like that. Also, we had like a little blog that we ran for a couple of years called Roots Game and Trail. And I guess I would say that would be like what I practiced writing in, you know. It was just kind of anything outdoor related, like even off-roading, you know, did everything.
That's awesome.
And was that all like, cause you came from Pennsylvania, right, to Texas?
Yeah, that's right.
So when you were in Pennsylvania and when you were like recreating and stuff, do you also keep a journal there, or was that something that you kind of started doing more once you started like exploring the SAM and other places here in Texas?
I've kept it from, you know, PA. So I think I probably started it in like 2010, something like that. Wow. And I think our little blog that we started in 2010 also. And so, you know, that has PA stuff too. Like a lot of that stuff was, we're doing a lot of trapping, you know, for fur bears and PA. So we, like a lot of articles about that. And then we kept the website going whenever we came down here to Texas. But you know, like I've got my friends that, you know, I'm still friends with in PA. They all wrote like little stories and stuff on it. And it was just kind of fun, you know. It was just see what would happen with it.
So it's not only a collection of like your own stuff, but like experiences your friends and had, like you guys had together too.
Yeah.
Dude,
stuff we had together. Stuff that my sister was living in Alaska at the time, so she wrote, you know, articles about going like on solo cross country skiing trips and stuff, and you know, it's just like, that's the whole thing, you know, it's fishing, hunting, trapping, hiking. But yeah, I mean, I guess that was just kind of the start of the writing.
Dude, that's pretty awesome. Thing.
That's pretty sweet. What part of Alaska is your sister in?
She just moved back to Pennsylvania, but she lived all over. She lived in Fairbanks. She lived in Valdez. She lived in Ketchikan.
Nice. Yeah, I'm from Fairbanks originally. So I was back there. Oh, yeah. I was there in July, July before. And I'll be there again next July. I love it up there. I haven't been up there in the wintertime in probably close to a decade. It's freaking gorgeous up there. I actually got to fish for the first time in Alaska this last time I went. And I caught a bunch of northern pike and a bunch of rainbow trout, a couple lake trout. And it was a blast.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, my sister got her her master's degree in wildlife biology from the university there.
Oh, dude, really?
That's awesome. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
From the Nanooks, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yep.
That's freaking awesome.
I didn't even know the University of Alaska offered a wildlife degree. I would have done my master's there. That's freaking sick.
Dude, I don't think you like the winters up there, bro.
Probably not, but I mean,
yeah, -40. She always like would have these pictures every year of her standing in front of the thermometer. It said -40 degrees.
Jesus. Yeah. I have a picture. I think we have -48 is the coldest one that I have a picture of us holding a thermometer in the front yard. And then I think I have pictures on a Google Drive somewhere of them sending me the pictures of the, I don't remember the name of the bank up there, but it's on the Fred Meyer grocery store sign and it says -68. I was just like, oh my goodness.
-68.
Dude, it's nuts.
To me, 30 degrees hurts. I can't even imagine what 68 would be like. -68, sorry.
Well, it's a little different. So, for instance, when I was in Texas, when it was 30 degrees, I was wearing 3 jackets, 2 pairs of pants, bundling up like crazy. Up there, if it's like -20, I'm just wearing like a sweatshirt and jeans. Like, it's not... of course, if you're not out, like if you're out there for an extended period of time, of course you need to bundle up, but it's not as of a quick bone chilling cold. It's more brisk. Mm-hmm. So it's a little different. I probably has to do with the humidity because Fairbanks is internal. But when I go down to Anchorage and it's wet and it's rainy and it's cold and it's windy, like it feels a lot colder. But yeah, I mean, in the central, it's not as bad.
That's something to that, Russell, for sure. Because yeah, it's like in Texas when you're in Houston and it's cold, just that damp, that damp frigid air just kind of like soaks through all of your layers. It feels miserable.
I remember there's times that like I was up there, I guess it would have been probably 2010, 2009 ish, and I was walking from my brother's like second story townhouse thing down the stairs to the car, and from the time I got from his stairs to the car, the wires inside of my headphones, this is obviously back before wireless headphones were a big thing, had literally frozen and broken. And so I was talking on the phone and I just couldn't hear anything, and I was like, what the hell's going on? I unplugged them and you know, it was working fine on my cell phone. And yeah, the wires just literally froze and broke inside from, you know, 15 seconds of walking outside. Oh my God. And then you can go to Chena Hot Springs, and the hot springs obviously are outside. And so the hot springs are like 100 and something degrees. So you can swim in them, and it's negative 40 outside, but there's signs everywhere that tells girls not to flip their hair when they come out of the water because it'll freeze and break off.
Wow.
Yeah, that's insane. Freaking nuts. I used to have pictures of me and my brother, and we'd go underwater and put our hair in a mohawk and come up, and it would freeze. We look like Jack Frost with, you know, a little frost and ice everywhere.
One of those pictures before.
Yeah, back in probably middle school or high school. Yeah,
that's crazy.
Crazy stuff, man. It gets that is so stupid crazy. Cold up there, but it's an awesome experience. Like how often do you go swimming and there's literally snow everywhere, and then your hair freezes? Like it's an awesome experience, and it doesn't really feel too cold out there because obviously the heat rising off of the hot springs. The walk from the hot springs to the building is miserable, but luckily it's like 100 feet, so it's not bad. But I don't think I could ever live there in the winter. It's too dark all the time. It's cold. Like,
yeah, those 30 days or whatever it is of darkness, that sounds pretty brutal. I don't know if I could do that.
Well, that's on the north end. So if you're in North Alaska, yeah, you don't see the sun for like 20 something days.
Yeah, that sounds miserable.
In Fairbanks, yeah, it's horrible. In Fairbanks, it's you get a little bit more sunlight. I think the winter solstice, you don't see the sun, and I think it's like 12 minutes a day ish average that you gain light or something like that. It's something weird like that, but you actually do see the sun when you're there. And then if you're, you know, further south, of course, you get more sunlight. But yeah, if you're up, I want to say, I don't want to lie to you, but probably like Barrow or something like that up north is where it's always dark. And then in the summer solstice, same thing. You don't ever get nighttime. Yeah. So vacations up there in the summertime are amazing because the days are so long. You can do so much. You can go hike and then go on another adventure and go down the river and then go fishing somewhere else. And it's like all this in one day because you have like 20 something hours of daylight.
See, that sounds more doable to me because you can get like blackout curtains or whatever. You know, you could simulate, I guess, nighttime, but if it's night all the time, you can't really simulate the daytime. You know, that sucks. I would go crazy.
I want to go back in the wintertime, but it's definitely different. And then the thing that sucks is, you know, it gets so cold in the winter that they shut the slopes down for one because it's dark all the time. So they don't want people going down the slopes in the dark. And for two, if it gets too cold, that snow pretty much turns to ice and it gets dangerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, so like the freaking slopes are shut down. So it's not like you can go skiing or snowboarding. There's like a month or two period where it's like ideal conditions to do so. But then the days aren't that long. So it's kind of different. The whole winter thing up there is it's not like you're going to Colorado and going skiing all the time. Or it's definitely different.
You go to work and then you tie flies.
right. If I had a place up there, I would definitely be tying flies a lot. So you're talking about fur bearing animals and trapping up in PA, right?
Yeah. I mean that was just one part of that little website that we were writing on.
So is that something that you did quite often up there?
Yeah. That was like a big part of winter. It was trapping muskrats and coons and foxes, we could catch them, mink, beaver. We did a lot of beaver trapping too.
So that's awesome.
So is that like something that you grew up doing? Is that something like your family did, or is that something you kind of like picked up?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, like before I'd go to school, my dad and I would check traps before, you know, before I'd have to go catch the bus and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
We grew up trapping. I mean, I think, you know, if anything, trapping was like what my dad liked doing more than anything, you know, so it was, we did that quite a bit. That's but it was awesome. Like a lot of work, you know. It's like one of the most work intense outdoor activities, you know, because it's, you can't not check your traps. You have to check them every day, you know. So if you have doing it before school, you're every day you're up at 5 a.m checking traps, you know, and like having to beat the clock to get back to get changed and put your clothes on and go to school and all that. And it's just like, you know, it gets tiring, you know. It's so I remember not loving it, you know, when I was a kid, because I'm like, oh man, dad. Oh yeah, and like in PA, the beaver season always opened up the day after Christmas. And so it was like, I just want to play with my toys. You
know? Like, my dad's like, gotta go
in the backyard getting he's like getting this trapping stuff ready, because to him, like, that was Christmas, you know. He's like, yeah, presents are great, but whenever we get to start trapping beaver, that's the real Christmas. So it was like, I just want to look at my stocking.
And right. So I'm assuming that you've canned pelts and eaten the meat, right?
Yeah. I mean, we later on, I mean, well, I've got beaver in the freezer now. Later on we were, eating beaver and stuff just cause it's like, why not? You know, all they do is eat tree bark, you know.
What's it taste like?
It's super mild. I mean, it's kind of how you would imagine beaver would taste. It's like there's no real irony flavor to it at all. It's just, it's super mild. It's probably a lot like eating a guinea pig or something.
So how would you prepare that? Like, what do you have, like a go-to recipe or anything for cooking beaver, or like a type, or like a certain way to cook beaver?
We've done roasts mainly with it. In the oven, I couldn't tell you like what it is, but you know, like 300 slow and low, right? Pretty much slow and low for anything, you know, it's going to taste fine. You know, done in the oven, done in the Instapot, you know, later on, crock pot. It's pretty much, if you can throw carrots and onions and like celery into the pot with it, it's going to taste good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, you can eat their legs like drumsticks and
really,
you know, but you cut the back straps off and it's, I mean, it's actually really, really mild tasting.
That's something I'd like to try. I've eaten Nutria rat before. And so I wonder if it's like similar to that.
Yeah. So what was Nutria like? Cause I bet it's very similar.
Yeah. From the way you're explaining, it's kind of similar. I would say it was a little, not quite gamey, but kind of gamey. Like it to me, it's almost really? Similar to like a squirrel. Like it's like a dark meat chicken almost kind of thing, but it has a little bit more of a little of a funk to it.
Yeah. Beaver's super dark also. Yeah. I would say though that, there's nothing about the meat with beaver that I'd say, has a funky kind of flavor to it.
Well, that's something I need to add to my list.
I mean, I've seen beavers and stuff, but I've never seen a beaver and be like, I think I want to try that. You know, it's just, but I mean, I'd be down to, like, especially after hearing you guys talk about it, I'd certainly be open to it. Have you ever tried eating the tail? Like, I hear that's pretty fatty.
Yeah. No, I never tried it. I actually have a couple beaver tail in my freezer. What I wanted to do is I wanted to skin them and tan the tail leather, mm-hmm. you know, and like make crafts with that, you know, wallets and things. That'd like that.
Awesome. That cool.
Yeah, I haven't got around to it yet, but I think I've got three or four of them in the freezer. But yeah, no, Jose, I never ate the tail or anything. Mm-hmm. But it is like, it's, you know, like yellow fat all through it. I don't know. There isn't much like sustenance there. There isn't much like actual meat on it, but it's like real gristly and fatty. And I imagine if you would just like skin it and put it in a pot or something like that and let it simmer for a long time, you probably get a lot of good fat out of it.
Yeah. Cause I heard or read somewhere that like trappers back in like the old days, whenever they trap beaver, cause like you were saying, it's such an intensive thing. They probably had a lot of lines or traps to check and stuff because of how fatty it was. They would often like, that'd be the first thing that they eat just to get like a boost of energy just from the tail or something like that. Now, I was just curious to see if you ever tried it. I mean, that's something I think I would be more interested to try than like the actual meat from the beaver, just because it seems so, I don't know, just different, I guess.
Yeah. Well, let's do it, man. Cause
dude, I'm down.
I got some in the freezer.
Dude, let's do it. We can try a few different things.
I'll just drive on up there or you drive down here.
Yeah, man.
Dude, that would be awesome.
So speaking of like trapping, so what did y'all do with all the pelts and things after you tanned them? Like did you use them for tying or did you sell them or what did y'all do?
Sold them. Yeah. Yeah. And we didn't do any of the tanning ourselves. You find fur buyers.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a huge auction You know, and it's an international auction, and it happens in Canada every year. There's actually two of them. It's like a North American Fur Auction, and then I can't remember what the other one is, but there's two main auctions. And what you do is you take your fur to a fur buyer, and then they look at all your furs and they grade them, you know, how well you did skinning them, how prime it is, you know, how big they are, and they shoot you a price and they say, okay, you know, we'll buy all your furs for $800 or whatever. And so that's pretty awesome. It's like, okay, great. Now I just made up for like all of the gas money and, you know, time that I spent that year skinning and checking traps and all that, and have a couple bucks left over or whatever. And so then what they do with all their furs, the ones that they buy from all the local trappers, is then they usually have someone else who takes them up to the fur auction. And then, you know, I mean, it's like Russians are there, Norwegians are there, wow. Chinese are there, Japanese are there, and they all come to Canada and they all bid on massive, you know, basically like crate loads of different animal furs, and they ship them on back and use them in garments and like boot linings, things like that. There's more of a market for it in Europe because it didn't quite get the stigma that North American, like Americans, you know, started treating fur like it was the worst thing ever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They went from like wearing beaver hats all the time to like hating it.
Yeah.
They get like faux beaver and faux leather, stuff like that.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. But like in Europe and Asia, it's still, I don't know, relatively popular. I wouldn't say like popular, I guess, but you know, that's where most of the market goes.
That's crazy. I never knew how any of that worked. Like, obviously you hear about it in like, you know, history books and stuff on how fur trade was a big thing back then, but
yeah.
I never thought about modernized fur trade and how that actually worked and how that went down. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really interesting. What's like super cool too is like you'd go to, you know, the trading post or whatever, like the one that we would go to, was F&T Fur Trading Post in Crabtree, and they don't lady that owned it, she died, but you know, it was like this lady in there that was like, just you would be taking like a step back in time, you know. You walk into her garage and there'd just be like beaver pelts all up on the wall, and there'd be like people in there just talking, and people would just be bringing in like all their furs. They'd be bringing in whole carcass animals and stuff, and she'd be like shooting people prices while she's like skinning a coyote, and like it was like something out of Wild West or something, you know. And then it was just a really cool experience. Yeah. And then she's talking about, you know, the Chinese market and, you know, the new like tariffs that are coming down on, like, you know, the ability for the Chinese to buy American fur and all this stuff. You're like, man, how do you people know this? Like, it's not what I would have thought you would have been talking about, because you're like skinning a coyote right now, smoking a cigarette. But like, she's all up on the, you know, all up on the fur trade. It was really cool.
That's freaking cool. Awesome. See, I've always kind of wanted to get into like fur stuff, not necessarily the fur trade, but like just tanning pelts and stuff, because, you know, in the past I've done some work with some snake skins, used to make some belts and wallets and coin purses and stuff like that, hat bands
cool.
Back in the day. But I always enjoyed doing that. And I think the only hides that I've tanned were squirrel, and those are such a pain. The skin is so thin. it's not very fun.
Yeah.
And of course, I wasn't experienced in tanning pelts, so I'm sure there's easier ways to do it than the way that I tried to do it. But it was just an extremely thin skinned animal, and it was kind of difficult. Of the three that I had, I ripped two of them, and I was like, oh, this sucks.
Yeah.
And that was back before I was a fly tire. So not looking back, it's like, man, that was some good fur I could have tied up some flies with.
Yeah, actually, that reminds me. Actually, this past, well, I guess it was 2 years ago now, I kept a couple of squirrels that I had shot during the small game season, and I sent them away to the tannery, and they were like, I mean, you know, you can look on, I use Moyle and Mink Tannery, I think they're in Idaho, but it's like you dry the pelts, you package them up in a cardboard box and ship them, and in 3 or 4 months, they'll ship them back to you totally tan, ready to go.
That's awesome.
And then you can use them for, you can use them for fly tying. So I sent, I can't remember, like, I don't know, a dozen squirrel pelts up to them. And I trapped some beaver up in Sam Houston National Forest. I trapped some coons up there, and I just sent all my pelts, and they sent them back. And I mean, I used a lot of the beaver pelts for like wall hangers and stuff. But like the coon pelts, I was experimenting with them, cutting them up, making them zonker strips and stuff like that. And then the squirrel, of course, like, you know, I mean, it just, it preserves it. So even if I don't mess with it for, you know, I've got a dozen of them, like, I'm not going to like, you know, that'd be a lot of squirrel nymphs I'd have to tie, you know, but so I'm like, I'm going to have these things for like 5 years, you know, and it's, the pelt isn't going to deteriorate at all.
That's freaking awesome.
Yeah. It's not bad price either. If you send it to Moylan Mink Tannery.
Well, that's good to know. I might have to do that. Moylan Mink.
It's, I think it's Moylan Mink. Moylan, it's either Mink and Moyl or Moylan Mink, something like that. Nice. Yeah.
And didn't you, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. What was it?
Oh, it's M-O-Y-L-E.
M-O-Y-L-E. Moyl. Okay.
Pretty sure.
Nice. Now I have to check
we'll look it up, and I'll put the link in the description for sure.
And
yeah, Moylan Mink.
And didn't you develop a fly using the squirrels that you shot in the SAM for flies for the SAM?
Yeah. That was the Sanjak squirrel.
Is
what I called it. I mean, it's just like, I mean, you know, the squirrel hair nymph is nothing new at all. You know, it's been around for a long time, but, it was something fun. Cause it was, you know, these are the squirrels that from the woods, you know, I mean, in some cases we shot them right on the banks of the East Fork, the San Jacinto, you know,
that's crazy.
Then we just, you know,
makes a full circle. It's a circle of life. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. It just, it's fun. I mean, it's a great fly too. It's super buggy with all that squirrel fur. It's, you know, real like coarse stuff. It kind of sticks out everywhere, traps a lot of air bubbles. It's really good.
It's that's surprisingly awesome. That's one I haven't tied yet, but Rob actually came. We the Aggieland Fly Fishers set up a like a little, I guess, fly tying event at a local brewery, and Rob was kind enough to come out and give a demo on like, we'll give a talk on fly fishing in the SAM. And I think he also mentioned his newest book, Fly Fishing Houston and South Asian Texas. And then he did a demonstration on the Sanjak. And dude, I mean, it looks super buggy, and I need to tie some. I just don't know why I haven't. But how many, do you have a running list of like the different species that have that you've caught using that fly?
Oh no, I should have. I mean, it's, I actually just the other day, somebody messaged me and just said that, it was one of the first guys that bought my book. His name was Bill. He bought my book, and, you know, I don't know, a month later he saw like the Sanjak squirrel, YouTube video, and he started tying them, and he messaged me. I mean, this was 3 years ago now. And he messaged me and was like, man, this fly is like killing it right now for me. And then just like last month, he messaged me again and just said something like, I just want to let you know, I'm still fishing this Sanjak squirrel. And it is still like crushing fish no matter where he goes. I just thought that was really funny.
Dude, that's so awesome.
But, yeah. And I think he was like, I mean, I think he's up in like the Dallas Waco area or something. So I he's been fishing it all over, but yeah, I mean, it's done awesome. I tied like a much smaller version. It was like a size 14. I usually for down here, I usually tie in between 8 and 10, but I tied like a size 14, and I was up in PA on the east side of the, on the eastern side of the state over by Scranton, like Carbondale area. And man, I caught one of the biggest browns I've ever caught in my life just on that thing. I mean, I didn't have like my nymph box. I had like all my Texas bugs that I had, you know, and I just was like, okay, I see some brown trout. I'll just throw on this, the closest thing I could come, you know, to a smaller nymph, something that they would be eating. It was just like a small Sanjak squirrel, and yep, big old brown trout ate it.
Dude, that's so freaking cool. Awesome. Dude, I love catching brown trout. I'm so excited for this upcoming brown trout season in the wintertime. I'm excited.
Hey, man, got to tie some Sanjaks.
I bet they'll hammer them. I need to.
I bet they'll hammer them up on the white.
Dude, most likely. Hopefully, I'll get to make a trip up there this year. So, but I'll watch the YouTube video and see if I can mimic some up. I need to get behind the vise, man. I freaking say that all the time, and I just don't. But I'm going to. I need to. I'm going to pull it out. Yeah, I'm just going to get to it.
Yeah, I need to as well. All my stuff. We moved fairly recently, so I still have all my stuff packed up. It's just like it's kind of like the last thing on the list, you know, to get. Yeah.
Well, with the little one, it unpacked. definitely changes your priorities.
Oh yeah, for sure. Any kind of extra time you had is now gone.
Yep. It's like, got to wait for them to go to sleep, try to get a little bit of you time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I bet you're looking forward to having a fishing buddy.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, man.
That's so awesome, man.
Dude, yeah, How old are you going to wait for him to be before you put a rod in his hand?
I don't know. I was kind of thinking, like, as soon as he can confidently stand up and walk around in the creek.
that's awesome.
That's so cool, man. How old was AJ when you first got her to start fishing, Russ?
The first time she fished with a push button, I want to say she was 3. And it was ridiculous. Okay. So she started fishing. Obviously, she loves worms. She's like a tomboy, but loves like big poofy dresses and makeup. Like she'll ask to put on a big princess dress. She'll put on her own makeup, paint her nails, and then want to go grab a bucket of worms and sit at the lake. Like, it's strange. I get both ends of the spectrum with her. And she'll sit there and she'll play with worms majority of the time. And then if she wants to fish, she gets mad at me because she wants to put her worm on. And when she catches a fish, she wants to take the fish off. And so she's constantly, you know, getting stabbed by the hook or getting, you know, finned by the fish. But she loves it. And I've got a fly rod in her hand twice. Both times with the 2-weight fiberglass rod that Jose actually gave me when I first started fly fishing. And she's yet to catch anything on it, but she has actually gotten a fly out there a few times. I have some pictures that I took of her actually doing it at Carpenter Dam here in Hot Springs one time. And I can't get her to calm down enough to actually get her like instruct her properly on how to cast and how to watch the strike indicator and stuff. But when it comes to her push button, she loves it. And then my oldest, first time I got her on a fly rod, in 24 hours, she caught over 100 fish. She stopped counting at 100. And I was like, I mean, this is ridiculous. At that point in time, I don't know if I'd even caught 100 fish total on a fly rod. And she did it in 24 hours. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. And, you know, I'm trying to, we're out camping and she's just fishing this little pond at the campsite. And I'm like, I need to get the tent ready. I need to get everything ready for the campfire and dinner. And she was like, I want to stay here and fish. And I'm like, okay. And so I just hear her every few seconds, got another one, Dad. Got another one, Dad. And I was like, oh, that's freaking ridiculous. And then the crazy thing is now she like doesn't ever want to go fishing.
I was like, burn out.
You like wore it up. Well, it's like, it's not fish. Like I told her, like, you stay out there. I was like, come on, let's go do something else. She's like, no, I want to fish. I was like, okay. And now it's like, hey, Peyton, you want to, you know, walk 15 feet away from our door and go fishing? No, I'm okay. I'm just like,
you want to know why? That girl wasn't fishing, man. She was catching. She's over. Yeah. Yep.
Well, if you could guarantee it, then maybe.
Right. Just maybe. Well, I mean, she was also, I think, 10 or 11 then. And now she's a 13-year-old teenage girl. And, you know, things change. She doesn't want to be seen with her dad in public anymore. And she's all worried about makeup. And I'm like, stop growing. You're getting too old too fast.
Dude, I think the last time I saw her, she was almost as tall as I was. Like, Jesus. It's freaking nuts, man.
Yep. I think she's like 5'5 now.
That's wild.
Oh, wow. Yep. She's super tall.
Yep. And then my youngest is up to my ribs already. And I was just like, oh, my goodness. We all stopped growing. They're growing like weeds, man. Like, I turn around, they grow another inch.
That's insane.
Yep. But it's awesome. I want to get my youngest onto a fly rod more. I think she'll like it a little bit more because the little rod she has is like a little, you know, Doc Demon size rod, little Walmart Moana push button rod. And, you know, she doesn't really fight the fish, and I feel like if she could feel the fight a little bit more, that she might like it a little more. Yeah. And then I don't gotta worry about keep putting worms on, you know. There's always, you know, when you're out there perch jerking, they're always stealing the worms. So if I throw a fly out there, and if I can get her to just calm down and listen enough to actually like get a cast to where she can learn how to get a fly out there, I think it'd be a lot more enjoyable for both her and I. But it's a work in progress for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It is.
Cool stuff, man. So, Rob, so who got you into fly fishing? Or is this something that you and your family did too?
No, we didn't do any fly fishing. I didn't really get too much into fishing either whenever I was, in grade school and all that. I mean, there were ponds and stuff, but where we grew up in Western PA was coal country. And so like the creek behind my house was just orange, you know, it was just, it's a lot better now. Like there's actually fish in it now, but, you know, just, yeah, we just grew up in like Western PA coal region. So it just, I mean, there were a couple of trout streams, but nobody, it wasn't like a big thing, you know? You know, you had to go to like Central PA, more on the eastern side to get into those like limestone, streams and, or like Northern PA kind of up towards Lake Erie where you get the steelhead running and stuff like that. So I don't know, just never really anything that I grew up doing. But I really got into it after college, moved up to, Northern PA, Northwest PA. And, remember like we were camping at a tributary of one of the main rivers up there. And there were like brook trout enhancement program signs, like tacked up on all the trees that were along this real beautiful creek. And like coming from not a trout background, I was thinking like, man, there's no way that there would be a trout living in this like tiny step across water. And, I remember I had like just this ultralight Shakespeare spinning rod. And I just like threw a rooster tail in this hole. Just, I don't know, did not think anything would happen. And then a brook trout ate it. And I was just like, that is nuts. And then after that, I just started fishing for native brookies. And then I was just like, the next logical step was like, okay, how do you fly fish for these things? And then after that, so I'd say it's like 2010 is really when I started fly fishing in earnest. And it was just like, man, this is super fun. You could tie your own flies. You know, you tie flies from the natural world around you, feathers, fur. I mean, it was just like everything came full circle. It was just so nice to have everything in that package. You know, it's like, man, this is everything that I love doing all wrapped up in one package.
Dude, that's freaking awesome. I've always wanted to catch like a brookie so bad.
They're so beautiful.
Oh yeah. Brookies. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's just one of those things that's like, okay, you get to hike in. I mean, it was blue lining, you know, it was just, it was the exploratory style of fly fishing. It was like, okay, we look at this, you know, it was before, you know, Onyx and all that stuff. So it was just like, okay, look at this topo map and we'll just pick a creek to hike into. And there might not be fish in there at all, but if there are they going to be like native brook trout? Or, you know, we knew where they stocked browns and stuff too. And we knew that there were holdover browns. So it was like, okay, let's look at the tributaries that flow into this main waterway. And then we'd hike up into those creeks and find like wild browns that, you know, had spawned up in these little creeks. And so we'd be catching like fingerling browns. So it was super fun. It was just a lot of exploring. And I mean, that was the same thing that got me into fly fishing Sam Houston National Forest too. It's like, okay, if we would take that blue lining aspect, you know, that blue lining style of fishing and just do it in Texas, it's like the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing you can do in Arkansas, right? You just,
yeah.
I mean, especially now what's cool about Arkansas is like, especially on like the western side of the state are all those smallmouth that they're now deeming to be like genetically defined. So it's like, you know, Wachita smallmouth,
Ozark smallmouth.
Smallmouth or Little River smallmouth.
Yeah.
Like there's all these genetic clades that they're figuring out, you know, and it's like, oh my gosh, you could like hike in each one of these tributaries and each one is genetically unique and you could just rack them up, you know, if you're into that kind of thing. If
dude, I love smallmouth
species, you know, species lists and stuff like that. So
yeah, so it's crazy because the smallmouth that Jose caught when we were at the Buffalo National River, I don't genetically I don't know what the difference is, but just physically there's the markings are so much different than those that I catch on the Washita and those that I catch on the Caddo River. And then I've seen pictures from some of my buddies that go fish the Cossatot coming out from Oklahoma and Arkansas, and their markings are completely different, and those are way different than, you know, one of our previous guests, Fred. He's up in upstate New York catching, you know, smallmouth.
Yeah,
and it's
just
crazy how much different they are appearance wise and technically the same species. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I wrote an article for Hatch Magazine because we did a trip to Eastern Oklahoma and we were fishing basically the Little River, I think is what it, what the tributary is, or what the main body of the tributary that we were fishing flowed into. And like, we didn't know that these were genetically unique smallmouth at the time, but it was like a week after we got back from the trip, I saw, and it was, you know, it was written in like 2022 or 2023. It was the scientific paper about how it's likely that these smallmouth are genetically unique to all the other smallmouth. And then it like proceeds to list off all these other genetically unique smallmouth that exist in the Oklahoma, Arkansas border there. And then we realized, we're catching smallmouth, yes, but they're like these genetically unique smallmouth to, like what you were saying, like what I would catch in PA. Yeah. You know, these aren't the northern variety. They were the Little River bass is what they called them, or Little River smallmouth. Mm-hmm. It was super cool.
That is pretty awesome.
I remember the first smallmouth that I caught, I didn't even realize it was a smallmouth. It wasn't until after the fact that I went back and looked at the pictures, because I didn't know smallmouth were in the body of water that I was fishing. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, just a small largemouth, or maybe it's a small spotted or something like that. And then, you know, snapped a picture, let it go. And then went, and when I was looking through, and I was actually using the app FishBrain at the time. And so I was trying to update some of the catches that I'd caught over the previous years. And I was like, that fish looks a little different. So I started looking at him. I was like, oh, crap. That's a smallmouth bass. I didn't even know I caught a smallmouth bass. So yeah. It's pretty interesting. But I mean, I love smallmouth fishing, but honestly, I could say I do enjoy warm water species, but I think I enjoy trout fishing better, more mainly because of the aspect, you know, you can find them in such small bodies of water. So when me and Jose went up to New Mexico, we didn't know what to expect when we went, you know, to a mountain stream catching trout. And I mean, it was a tiny body of water. It's the Cimarron River, but like to us, it was a creek. You know, it's tiny. Like you could literally walk across this thing, you know, step across it and be on the other side without even stepping in the water. Yep. And it was just loaded with trout. And there were some spots where we pulled off the road. And I mean, you just see hundreds of trout just in this one little pool right next to this ripple. And it's crazy how many there are. And there's multitudes of species. You know, you got your rainbow trout and you got your brook trout and you got your brown trout, and they'll just live in these tiny little streams of water. And so I want to make some, you know, northwestern trips and head out west and do that. Some blue lining over there, because I've never done that. But I think that would just be awesome to have like a week long camping trip, blue lining, camping in the plains or in the mountains. Like, awesome.
Yeah. No, that's what's beautiful about trout fishing, is them living in that step across water. But also at the same time, it's like, man, I found that same, like it sounds kind of like silly when you talk about long ear sunfish compared to trout, but you know, cause they don't get to be, you know, 16, you can't find like a 16 inch long ear sunfish. Yeah. Like you could find like a 16 inch cutthroat hiding under a cut bank or something like that. But I mean, man, just hiking into some of the creeks in Sam Houston National Forest, and you know, they're sandy bottom, fairly clear, and like throwing a dry fly and then, you know, having a long ear swim out from a cut bank and eat it. It's like, wow, that's almost, it's like the same feeling that you would find doing that in a brook trout stream.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, if you pick that stream up and move it to further north and add some gradient to it, you know, people would be like, oh man, this is an amazing brook trout stream or whatever, you know. But it's, you know, for catching brookies, we're catching long ear sunfish. And I know it sounds kind of silly. It's like, oh, it's a long ear, you know, they fit in the palm of your hand. But also at the same time, that was like, when I'm looking at a long ear and I'm, you know, I look back at pictures of native brook trout, I'm like, well, those are also fitting in my hand. You know what I mean? I mean, every once in a while you catch like a tiger shark of the tiny creek you're fishing, where it's like a 12 inch brook trout with a kype on it, you know, but it's like, you catch what, one or two of those a year, you know, and from like a true, you know, native stream. But like most of the time you're catching these, I don't know, 6 inch brookies. Yeah. And it's like, well, I'm catching these 6 inch long ear too. And they're eating dries, or, you know, I rigged up my dry dropper. They're like eating these nymphs that I'm throwing at them. It's, I don't know. And then you'll catch a spotted bass, which is the equivalent of the tiger shark of these tiny East Texas creeks, you know, and it's like, that's the king of the hole that's swimming around eating long ear fry and stuff like that. So,
see,
It's cool. I got like the same feeling. I got that same like exploratory style feeling and like the same jitters, you know, fishing for these warm water species down here.
Yeah.
And I've had the good fortune to have fished with Rob before. And I can attest that I don't think I've ever seen anyone get as excited catching a long ear or something like that than Rob. But I mean, to be fair, like, man, I truly believe that sunfish in general, at least here in Texas, are like often overlooked. They're so pretty. And yeah. Like, I mean, all the varieties, like some bluegills have some amazing colorations, like especially when they go to those deep, like oranges or chestnut orange colors. And then of course, long ears, like the turquoise and the orange when they contrast are so gorgeous. And my personal favorite is like red breast sunfish, which I often get confused for long ears, but on the San Marcos River, they're just gorgeous. And I personally love catching sunfish, especially like on a topwater and like a light 2-weight, 3-weight, whatever. And so to have seen Rob like share that same like enthusiasm, if not more, it's infectious, man. Like, he gets super stoked. He get as stoked for like a nice long ear as he would for like a nice spotted bass. Like it's awesome. And
it's funny because you see your fly get taken under and you're like, oh man, this got to be a bass. Like it feels heavy. And then you're like, nope, it was just this ragged monster, like long ear sunfish. You're like, how's this thing fighting so hard?
And they do fight hard.
Sunfish are, they're like pound for pound, like they are freaking the most aggressive fish that I've caught. Like I love catching long ear and green sunfish. Green sunfish are such aggressive little bastards. Like I remember there was this pond.
They get big too, yeah.
They do, and their mouths are freaking massive. So there's this pond in the neighborhood that I used to live in San Marcos, Texas, and it was loaded with some solid like slab greenies. And I was out there back when I was a conventional fisherman throwing my bait caster with a topwater frog. And numerous times I had a green sunfish nail a topwater frog and actually get both hooks in the lip. Like, dude, he wanted it. They're fun to catch.
Sometimes though, like there's where I live, there's like a pond I could walk to like literally 10 minutes away. Dude, when they're like feeding aggressively, they will literally like just launch themselves out of the water after the dry fly. And they'll miss it, but they'll just like straight up like free willy, man. It's just, it's wild. It's so fun to fish for them. Right. Like if someone told me that I can only fish for bluegill with like a 3-weight for the rest of my life or panfish with a 3-weight for the rest of my life, I think I'd be fine. Like, it's fun.
Yeah. You're like, okay.
It's so fun.
Yeah. And like, and you'll catch, you'll catch, well, I don't know, like a dozen bluegill or long ear whenever you go out, and then you'll catch like a warmouth or, you'll catch something like some totally bizarre hybrid or whatever. And you're like sitting there looking at it, wondering, what do you make of it? Like, what is this crossed with? This is some like green sunfish, bluegill cross or something. I mean, they just get like really neat.
Yeah, they do. Especially when they're all colored up during spawning season in the springtime. It's just like you pull out like freaking aquarium fish. It looks like they're so bright colored.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Dude, I love it. Yeah, it's awesome.
They look tropical. Yeah.
And then kind of ironically enough, the long ears, whenever they're all flashed like that, they actually kind of have that white on the bottom of the fins, almost like a brook trout does too. So it's funny that, you're comparing the two, they kind of had that same almost coloration.
They exhibit all the exact colors. Yeah. They just don't have like the spots, like the red spots, but they've got just pretty much all the exact colors.
So did that fascination or like that, I guess those similarities to blue lining and PA and stuff like that, did that kind of help inspire you to write about the sand?
Yeah, it was, I had just enjoyed fishing these creeks. And so again, I would just like write them down in my outdoor journal. And then that way I would remember like where I parked, how I got in, what I caught that day, whether or not it was worth it for the effort to get in there. And then it was right at the start of COVID. I mean, I guess it was like 2019 is when I started writing Fly Fishing the Sam. And it was just one of those things where it's like, I can't be the only one that would enjoy something like this, and it's one of those resources. It's closest national forest to Houston, nobody's fishing these little creeks. And, like if you were going to have like a community of like-minded anglers that I would enjoy hanging out with, like Jose, like you and Xavier, and it would just be like these guys that like hiking in and doing this kind of stuff. Like that was who I wrote the book for, It's just people that would enjoy that same style, that same exploratory aspect of it.
Yeah. And I could kind of like attest to that. So during COVID, when I heard of the SAM, or when I thought of the SAM, I only thought of of hunting, because I knew some people would go out there for a public land opportunity. And, but I never even thought about fishing in the forest itself. And it was during COVID. And I remember I came across a post on Instagram about fly fishing the SAM. And I didn't know at the time that fly fishing SAM, meaning the Sam Houston National Forest. And so I clicked on it, and I think I followed the link. It might have been your page or someone posted about it or whatever. But I landed on the page and read more about it, and read that I was, and saw that it was about fly fishing Sam Houston. So I was like, dude, I'm only like an hour and a half from it, from like the close, or like 45 minutes from the closest stretch or something. So, and I didn't have anything to do. I got kind of burnt out of fishing around College Station, because we were hitting all the same places, and I was ready for trying something different. And so I bought it, and my buddy and roommate Javier and I, we were like, dude, let's just go. And we're not doing anything else. So we went, and we only explored like a small section of it, caught up some beautiful long ear, and can't remember what else. I think maybe some bluegill. And then we came back, and then we posted about it, and Rob actually saw it and commented, and he ended up inviting us to go fish with him a second time. So we explored the same river, but a different stretch of it. And man, it was just so much fun. We caught so many different fish. I think, off the top of my head, I think Rob, you caught a crappie, long ear. We caught some different hybrids, bluegill. I think we caught.
One of you guys caught a nice spotted bass on top wire. You were using a Lana bug, and I remember that was like killing it. And that was the first time I saw the Lana bug just like crushing fish. And I was like, oh wow, that works very well.
Dude, the Lana bug is one of my favorite flies. It's so awesome. And no, I missed one, because there was this, like, we were going around this little bend, and I felt like I had made a bad cast. So I was like stripping in really fast, and this spotted bass just exploded on it. And I had it on briefly, but I got such a crappy hook set on it, I ended up losing it. But dude, you were losing your mind. I was losing my mind. We're just like, what is happening? And then I think it was in the next hole over, you ended up catching a really nice spot on, I think it was actually the San Jack squirrel, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
But yeah, that was a fun trip, man. And I mean, yeah, dude, first of all, the book that you wrote is well written, and it's super awesome. If anybody likes exploring, and what's cool about the Sam Houston, it's like, I feel like it's not as well known of a fishery, and which, I mean, I guess depending on your perspective, might be a good thing. It's like a hidden gem in East Texas, if you will. But it's awesome, man. If you love exploring, like blue lining, like you had mentioned, it's like the perfect place to go. I never would have, done it or tried it or even heard about it for your book. It's a really cool place. And I actually haven't gone probably since you and I fished it the last time, which was like 3 years ago almost now. It's a cool book. So if anybody's listening and wants to check it out, highly recommend it. It's a blast. I'm going to have to take you, Russell, whenever you come down. I think you'd dig it. It's really cool.
Dude, I definitely will. Sounds like it.
Yeah. I mean, if you like doing like smallmouth creek fishing and stuff, or pan fishing in Arkansas, I mean, it's a little different, obviously, but yeah. It's the same style, it's the same thing. But yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, thanks, Jose. I mean, that's like, guys like you are hearing that, from guys like you, like, man, that's all I wanted out of it, is just like-minded anglers to, and like start there, but I mean, there's still, you got Angelina National Forest, you got Sabine National Forest, you got all these other national forests, mainly on the east side of the state, that, I'm sure you could find the same creeks. It was kind of one of those things. It's like, there's fish in all these creeks, just go explore them, go blue line them,
See, I love doing that here in the Ouachita National Forest. There's some places that I found that it doesn't look like very many people go to. You don't see any trails, mm-hmm. any foot traffic in the area, no trash. Like, you're not finding the typical signs that somebody's been there. And, I've just walked up creeks, and then it's weird because there's some areas that are literally an eighth of a mile from an interstate highway, and just nobody goes there because it's, you know, national forest. And there's been numerous times that I've walked and I'm coming out to a road and I'm like, oh crap, I drive over this bridge all the time and never knew that this water was here. First of all, second of all, that it is accessed from where I actually parked at and walked upstream or downstream, whatever the case may be. And I've actually taken Jose to one of them. Mm-hmm. There's a little spot that we parked and it's that one was a well-trafficked area. But I actually walked up further from where me and him stopped. And I mean, it gets to some small water with some decent holes and there's some good, you know, shoals and ripples and stuff. And it gets freaking gorgeous up there. And that's where it starts going from in town of Hot Springs towards the National Forest. And dude, it's so much fun. Like next time Jose's here, I want to take him up there. There's two bodies of water that I want to take him to that are Blue Line style. And I've found quite a few other places for kayaks and stuff that I want to try to get him on some pickerel and whatnot. But other than that, like there's a lot of blue lining opportunity up here that I absolutely love. Yeah. So I know I would love going to the Sam Houston.
Yeah. I mean, Arkansas would, doing that stuff in Arkansas would just be awesome.
It is. And the thing that's difficult for me though, is because I'm in the Diamond Lakes area. So I have, you know, a Lake Washita, I have Lake Hamilton, I have Lake Catherine, then I got DeGray, I got Lower DeGray. And so there's all these other prime opportunities, but sometimes I just feel like going out and just walking a creek, you know? And, so it's, I have both options, but one, you know, is a little more relaxing to me.
Dude, I don't know what it is about creek fishing, especially like urban creeks. You just, I guess part of the excitement is you just don't know what's living there. You don't know what you're going to catch.
Yeah, exactly.
Like there's
and it's really never the same. Yeah. I mean, you can catch the same fish out of the same hole, but then like you'll catch also completely different fish out of the same hole.
Dude, like before fishing with you, Rob, I think the first spotted bass I've ever caught was actually in a drainage ditch here in College Station. So there's like a little it's a park and there's a lot of like a lot of people go and play frisbee golf, and there's a creek and it feeds into like this little for lack of a better term drainage ditch, I guess. And so we went there one day and it was one of the deeper spots, and so that's where we were fishing it. And to my surprise, there was like I caught like a 8 or 9 inch spotted bass out of there. And we've caught like long ears hanging out there. There's bluegill. We've caught, what else have we caught? In the creek. So I guess it's more like a spillway really, but because it drains off into the, and feeds the creek that runs behind the amphitheater. We've fished all around that creek. I mean, we've caught warmouth out of there. We've caught crappie. We've caught largemouth. We've caught bluegill and various hybrids. We've caught, what are they called? Bullhead catfish. We've caught, I don't even know, dude. The list just goes. I think we have a running list now of like 9 different species we caught out of that one little like spillway / creek thing. I mean, it's insane. And it's right in right in the heart of like College Station. I mean, like literally close to one of the busiest roads. And every time like people pass by, I'm like, dude, there's fish there. Like, oh yeah, man, there's all kinds of stuff. And it's just so funny. Like people will just like, they just don't believe it until they see us.
Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy.
Yeah, man. And that was kind of the reason for the second book was Fly Fishing Houston in Southeastern Texas, was to just showcase that exact same thing, man. It's like you drive over these same creeks every day and, you know, and people often will like lament that they live in Houston because they want to go to Colorado. And I mean, like who doesn't, right? But you know, this is where we live. We live in Houston and you don't have to only fish twice a year because those are your, you know, your semi-annual trout trips, you know, and then for the rest of the year, you just keep your 3-weight like stacked in your closet, gathering dust or whatever. It's, you can break that same 3-weight out and go hit all these little creeks. And then whenever you do go on your trout trip, your cast isn't terrible.
Right.
And like you've actually done some practice and you know, you don't like, you're not one of those people that's like, yes, I fly fish. Well, I've fly fished twice in the past 3 years.
Right.
You know, it's like you actually enjoy this thing because it is a fun thing to do, especially when you know that you've got multitude of fish species that you can catch right out your back door, especially because I know Jose, you went down and fished Braes Bayou and you caught grassers, and it's like, there's a lot of grass carp in there. I mean, not just grass carp. There's a lot of different species of carp in there.
Dude.
Or a fish in general. And you're like, holy moly. And then when you actually land a grass carp, you're like, oh, that was worth it. Because this thing is 10 pounds, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And so that's, so yeah, I want to talk about that because I don't think, I know I mentioned to you briefly, Rob, but there was more to that trip than I thought. So I have never caught it. Well, let me rephrase. The only carp I had hooked, common carp, lost every single one I hooked. The only, like, I guess carpy fish that I caught was the koi that I caught with Russell in Arkansas. But in Texas, wow, I had never caught a carp. I've hooked carp, but I had to take my buddy to the airport. And it was early in the morning. So I took him to the airport and I wanted to do some fishing while I was there since I already made the trip. So I packed my fly rod and it was like in the heat of summer. It was super hot. I just didn't really know how braids would be, looking. And the only reason I knew to look at braids, because I wanted to target carp specifically, was because of your book. And so I happened to pop into Bio City Angler and I talked to somebody who worked there, and I unfortunately cannot remember his name, but really cool dude, really helpful. And so we got to talking and I was like, yeah, and I just happened, like, in conversation, like, yeah, man, so I'm here, and, I dropped my buddy off the airport, want to fish while I'm here since I already made the trip. I was thinking about hitting up braids, and he was like, oh, dude, I fish braids all the time. You should definitely check it out. Like, there's carp all, everywhere, mostly grass, but you can find some common carp and stuff too. I was like, sweet. So mm-hmm. he pointed me to, like, a general location, walked a bit, and, I mean, dude, like, I found carp everywhere, grass carp everywhere. It was just insane. Saw some mullet too, some small schools of mullet. And so I ended up getting to the spot and I found some carp and I just kept casting at them and I was spooking them and finally got one. Well, actually I found a couple different things happened. I ended up seeing some tilapia, which I had never really seen in the wild before. And then I saw some of these other fish that I thought were tilapia. And so they were kind of feeding on the edge close to the deeper part of the bayou. And so,
were they the plecos?
Dude, I think it was actually
the armored catfish.
I think it was actually Paku. No.
Oh, dude, I'd believe that. They caught Paku up in like Woodlands area.
So the reason being, cause like I saw the tilapia.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. Dude, so I saw the tilapia and they were closer to where I was, but they were smaller. And I saw these bigger fish, like they looked rounder in shape. And every now and again, they would kind of like turn to feed and I would see a flash of orange on the belly. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know if I've ever seen a tilapia, like even a picture with like an orange belly like that. And so what I ended up doing was I was casting towards like the deeper part of the bayou, letting the current swing my fly into them. And every now and again, like I would see one kind of like go for it, but it would miss. And then I would, like, I guess when it got to the shallow part, it catch the attention of a tilapia. But they would kind of, actually they did eat, but I would just make a terrible hook set and just miss it completely. Just whiff it. This one time, the last time I did the same thing, let my fly swing into the school. And I was going to try and pull my line to do a back cast to cast again. And I met resistance. And so I just set the hook, but it was a really crappy hook set. And this fish went ballistic, man. I mean, it just went like wild, started peeling my drag. It just happened so fast. I didn't really know what was going on. And so I started like trying to get my, get line on, like catch up to him. And I turned him. And when he turned towards me, like the entire shape of it, it just did not look like a tilapia. And I was like, for the life, and I had it on, it turned towards me and it spit the hook and it just, and the whole school just like disappeared. And so I just chucked it up to like, oh damn, I just lost like a really nice tilapia. And so I ended up just walking down some more, ended up hooking my first grass carp. And I walked it down to a spot that had like some steps so I can get to it, cause the walls are pretty steep. And dude, I released it in literally 3 minutes. I walked back up. I saw some smallmouth buffalo, saw another carp. And I mean, 3 minutes from releasing the last carp, I hooked another one. Nice one.
And
same thing. I walked it down to where I was able to get down and it actually snapped my line. And I just called it a day from there. And so I was like trying to.
Oh, I don't know. You hooked two. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. I hooked two, landed one. And so I started doing some research on what the fish could be. And my buddy actually sent me a photo someone caught a pacu somewhere else, and it had that same orange belly, that same shape. I was like, holy crap, dude, I might have actually hooked a pacu. And then I got bummed because, like, damn, I hooked a pacu. I was fine living with the fact that I lost a nice tilapia, but the fact that I may have lost a nice pacu just kind of hurts a little more. But
dude, that just means you need to make another trip out there, target specifically those.
Dude, I've been wanting to, and Rob's like, dude, we need to go fishing, and we just haven't, unfortunately. And I know this weekend, I think both of us are going to be at an event that we probably can't go fishing this weekend, but we definitely need to try it. But yeah, so if that's not a testament to like how Rob's book can really help out, then I don't know what is. I mean, it's a really cool book. If anyone's living in Houston who likes to fish, wants to like get out, definitely check it out. But yeah, Rob.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's those rivers are what's the little bayous and stuff like that you drive over every day. I mean, that's what's like, that's the cool part is like what you just said. I mean, you would not believe that number of fish species that are in Brays, you know, right. And you just look at it and it's like this cement lined ditch and you're, you just drive over and you just think, okay, you know, whatever. They're just, I don't know. It's nothing, you know, it's nothing to anybody just who doesn't fish really. And then you actually get in there and you do what you did where you're walking along and you're like looking at the water and you're saying, I mean, you know, there's a channel catfish, there's tilapia right there. There's smallmouth buffalo. There's, you know, grass carp, common carp. It's, and then you start seeing like schools of like hundreds of mullet and you're like, this is actually a pretty resilient waterway here. And I mean, they've electrofished, saltwater species out of that bayou.
Really?
They've electrofished sheep's head and reds. Wow. Not on like the cement section of it, further downstream where it gets to a naturalized bank again. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's the same waterway, you know.
Dude, that's crazy. I got an opportunity to fish it very briefly a few months ago, and it was tough. I'll give you that. I only fished, I'd say probably maybe 300 foot of it. I had both my kids with me. We got there around 10 o'clock, and it was already triple digits at that point. And I just felt horrible for my kids. You know, they're standing under a bridge in the shade and people are, you know, riding their bicycles by and their rollerblades. And I'm just down there trying to cast at these carp. And I saw a bunch of mullet, a bunch of carp, some other fish. I'm not sure what they were. They may have been tilapia. And everything was just so spooked and it was hot out there. And so I fished for literally 30 to 45 minutes. And it was just very difficult. And I was like, I need to go there because I was just on my way back up from the coast. And I was like, you know what? And I made it a point. I wanted to bring the fly fishing Houston, Southeastern Texas, but I left it sitting on my couch. And so when I got down to the coast and I did everything that I was doing that week, I was on my way up and I was like, well, screw it. I'm just going to like go try to fish Brays anyways. I was like, I don't have the book. You know, I didn't read that section. I didn't take a picture of it. I didn't have the book with me. I was like, well, I'll just try to wing it. So I called Jose, but Jose was asleep or something. He didn't answer the phone. I'm like, damn. So I just pulled up Brays on my phone and I found a place. And I was like, man, this doesn't really look like somewhere I want to fish with my kids. Like, it was a real rough area. And so then he called me like almost right after that. And right after I got to that place and he's like, no, try this place. And so he pointed me in the direction and I got over there and it was definitely a lot safer for, you know, for me and my kids, but the fishing was extremely difficult. And if I could get there earlier in the morning and like actually dedicate a few hours to it, I'd hope I'd have some success. But the little bit of time that I got to spend there, it was a very difficult 30 minutes of fishing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And that's what, I mean, I remember writing that in the book being like, you're going to see carp, but seeing them and catching them are two totally different things because, you know, some of these fish just don't care what you throw at them. And then others sometimes would like chase, like race each other to intercept the fly, you know? So it just, you never know what you're going to get, but like, that's why it's like you show up, you see carp, you make a couple casts to them. If they're not having it, move on. Like, don't spend, you know, hours trying to catch these two grass carp that keep coming up and, you know, maybe looking at the fly and then going back down into the deep section, then coming back up on the apron, like just move on. Cause you're going to find like, you know, 20 carp by the end of the day and you're going to find one of them or two of them that are going to want to eat.
Yeah.
And then when you do hook into them, you're like, oh, this thing is gigantic. This is, you know, a massive fish.
Dude, and the wild thing is, like, common carp, I mean, usually it's kind of like a one-shot deal where you're done, you know, if you even get the shot. For these carp, like you said, there were some that I casted at that were super skittish. Like, as soon as the fly hit the water, they were gone. And then there were other, mm-hmm. there were other carp who just, like, they just did not care. And then the carp that I got to eat, like, I mean, dude, I literally landed either in their face, and it was more of like a reaction thing. The last one that I hooked, I didn't make as good of a cast as I was hoping. It landed a little bit behind it and to the left of it. And this carp actually, like, turned around,
spun around
and chased it down and ate. And I got it right at the top of the hook. I was like, what is that? I've never seen carp behave like that. It's wild.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's something about those grass carp that are different than any other grass carp, because you'll go fish grass carp in other bodies of water and they do not care at all. And then it's like these ones, they just, they can't help themselves because they live on the concrete, you know? It's not like they don't have all this, like, lush vegetation that they can eat, all this duckweed and stuff they can eat every day. It's like, you got to eat what you can get, you know?
Exactly.
It's doggy dog world in the bayou.
For real.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's pretty forgiving, because I made some really terrible casts, and they'll, like, they'll go off into the main, like, I guess the deeper section, and go down, and then, like, maybe 5 minutes later, another one, or maybe it might be the same one. I don't know, but dude, there's going to be shots. You're going to have your shots. Like, they're very, at least in that stretch, they're pretty forgiving, even for a novice like me. So, I mean, it's a pretty cool experience, man. Like, fly fishing in Houston, like, I mean, dude, there was like a major highway coming over, like, where I was. It's just like catching carp underneath that. It's just, so it's wild. Like, talk about an urban jungle. Yeah. Like, first, Rob writes a book about fly fishing, like, the, you know, for lack of a better term, the Eastern Texas jungle, and now the urban jungle. It's just, so it's a wild experience, man. Catching these big fish while, like, people are jogging by or, like, riding their bikes. It's wild.
Yeah, it is.
I had a couple times where I was in a back cast and here comes somebody on a bicycle or rollerblades. I'm like, I just stop and let my fly line fall, and then they go by. Right, and they're like, oh, sorry. And it's like, they're probably thinking, look at this loser out here. What the hell is he waving his ferry wand around for? I got some freak out here. But it was definitely interesting.
Yeah, I mean, but you'll run into other people that have fly rods. I mean, that's another wild thing. It's like, it's, you know, I mean, on Braze, because Braze has the notoriety, you know. People like Danny Scarborough have been fishing it for years and years and years, who have, you know, I mean, he guides on it, you know what I mean, for the urban carp thing. But then I remember one time I was in a completely other – I was in the northeast side of Houston on a little creek that I had never been to before. I, like, parked in a cemetery, and I, like, went through the woods. And I came out the other side, and there's a guy standing there with a fly rod. And it was like, and he was like, yeah, this is like my little creek. Like, this is where I come all the time. And cause there just a big rainstorm had gone through. And he was like, you'll see that this creek hardly fluctuates at all in terms of flow rates. Like, it comes back down really fast after a rain. He's like, I come here. I love fishing this little creek because, I mean, it's got cichlids, bass, all this stuff in it, and it comes down like a day after a heavy rain. And it was just too funny, and just such like an odd, weird, small community, especially the Houston fly fishing community, where it would come through this like cemetery out in this, you know, you would think you'd never find, if anything, you're going to have to like deal with like a homeless dude like bathing in the creek or whatever, and then no, there's like another fly fisherman standing on the creek when you come out the other side. It was just crazy.
That is nuts. Hey, maybe the homeless dude bathing is what's seasoning the water for y'all. They're chumming it for you, getting the fish all hungry.
It's like so good. Dude, you know,
that's one thing that really surprised me. Like, I love catching Rios. I did not know that Rios were in Houston. Xavier
and big ones.
Yeah, some huge ones. Like Xavier, he would go visit someone, and he was like, dude, you won't believe it, but I caught this massive Rio. He sent me a picture. It's like, Jesus. Like, I had no idea. And then whenever
Xavier's spot was cool, his little cichlid hole.
Yeah, man. And I think you might have fished there with us one time. And
a couple of times.
Dude, it's crazy. And I would be, so like you were talking about, like the like, I guess, speciation of smallmouth, you know, like in these distinct water bodies. Yeah. I would be curious about a genetic study on Rio Grande, or yeah, Rio Grande cichlids in Houston versus like Central Texas or South Texas. Because when when I was holding, like, I eventually caught one, and when I was holding it, it looked different than what I was used to catching back in Central Texas. Like,
oh, dude, Jose, yeah, and you know what, too, because from what I think is that there is a pocket of them in Houston, but they're not west of there, mm-hmm. because I don't think it's warm enough year round for them, mm-hmm. right? And so even like they probably did, you know, stock them, because I think they stocked them statewide, but only like pockets of them have made it. I mean, and I don't know this to be true, but I've never caught them outside of the city. And so you're right. Like, what if there was this population of Rio Grande cichlids that over time has basically just been isolated in Houston and has never, you know, been able to get any kind of genetics from any outside source. And so what if they did start developing like their own? Oh, that'd be really cool, yeah, man. I've heard the same thing about Louisiana too. I think there's populations of them in Louisiana too.
Yeah, they're considered invasive there. They're like, I think they're supposed to like kill them if they catch them or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, man, I don't know what it is. Cause like when I caught it, I for a brief second, I thought it was a tilapia just because it looked so different. But at the same time, it looked so similar. I was like, I can't tell if this is a Rio or a tilapia. And I started looking at it closer and I was like, no, it's a Rio for sure. But it just looked way different than what I had caught, you know, in Austin or even out in the hill country on the Llano. You know, it's just like it's a cichlid. Like, there's no arguing about it. It just looks different.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is about it. It just, you could tell it's a cichlid, but it don't look like, well, at least what I would say a normal cichlid looks like. But yeah, dude, it's wild, man. I thought it was super cool. Houston and I guess urban fishing in general, it's just, it's a whole nother world, but it's so awesome. It's really neat.
Dude, I'm miss catching cichlids. I think we should make a trip whenever I come next month or in October, whenever, if that's next month. And I think we should go. Not only that, so you know my buddy Daryl, right? Mm-hmm. So he texted me earlier saying that if we needed a place to stay, he lives in Jarrell now. Daryl lives in Jarrell. So if we need a place to stay, he has two spare bedrooms. So I was thinking that maybe if we can make the trip there, it's an easy drive to Round Rock. Might be able to hit some brushy early morning action before we head to Ironfly. So just kind of throwing that out there if you want to do that, because I could definitely use some Rio time.
Dude, let's do it. Are you going to go to the Ironfly, Rob?
I don't think so. I'm going to that the Aggieland Roundup this weekend. And Ironfly is what, next weekend?
The 21st.
October 21st.
Oh, the 21st. Yeah. Okay. Because I think next weekend, I'm doing that 25 on the, or not, the, yeah, October 7th and 8th, I'm doing that 25, the Lone Star 25 fly fishing tournament, 25 different species throughout the state.
So what's that? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's an Orvis event, and it's a multi-species tournament where it's 2 days of fishing. You try and catch 25 different species on the fly, but like it did it kind of neat where each species is weighted in terms of like location and how hard they are to catch. And so if you know, like tarpon's on the list, you know, so it's like tarpon's 500 points or whatever, but so is bowfin. You know, so if you catch a bowfin on the fly, 25, but then, you know, it's like bass is 100 points, sunfish is 100 points. So it's one of those things that's like you're probably going to catch a bunch of those easy to get species right off the bat and then have to go hunting for, you know, your tarpon if you're down down on the coast or south, or you're going to have to go try and find your bowfin or, you know, try and get your, I don't know, gator gar or whatever. I don't remember what the points are right off the top of my head, but like a grass pickerel's on there, you know, so it's one of those, it's a really cool tournament. I mean, it's a cool concept, I think.
That's awesome. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, I haven't either. It's really neat.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I think signups are still on, so you guys should sign up.
Is it a Texas only thing?
Yeah. It's the Lone Star 25. And then, they did a, I think they started it in Colorado. They did a 25 species, tournament in Colorado, and it went off pretty good. So they've made the Lone Star 25.
That's awesome.
And it's an Orvis hosted thing.
Yeah. Yeah, like we got to go to Orvis the day before, check in, you know, do all that stuff, get our piece that you're supposed to show in the photo, you know, that whole thing.
That's really
that would be interesting. I wonder if there's any plan for anything like that in Arkansas, because that would be fun. I mean, it ranges from rainbow trout, brown trout, you know, of course, warm water species. Yes, yeah, striper. You got your spotted gar, your long nose gar, your short nose gar.
You know, I would drive up to do that in Arkansas for sure. That would be so cool.
I might have to swing by an Orvis and be like, hey, you guys ever heard of this?
Or it could be a podcast sponsored event.
That's an idea. That is an idea. And there are some breweries up here that maybe we could plan something out like that. Let me start talking to some people.
Yeah, let's talk about that, you know, off camera.
Right.
So Rob, how does that work? Are like are the points accumulative? So like, for example, if you catch like 5 bluegill, you know, you get those however the aggregate point would be, or amount of points would be, or is it just like they all, like, once you catch a bluegill, like, that's it?
Yeah, that's what my understanding of it is. I had the same question originally. Was okay, so I could just sit there all day in a bluegill hole and like catch points after points. But no, it's I'm pretty sure it's each species, you're one and done.
I see.
So there is a max amount of points that you can get, assuming that you would catch all 25, which I don't even think that's possible.
Right.
But that's why it's kind of neat, where, you know, they kind of picked fish that would be difficult to find and catch throughout the state, you know, and like made them, like, you know, if you're South Padre and you can catch a tarpon, well, then that's going to be weighted as heavily as if you paddle into some gator swamp and catch a bowfin, kind of right. thing, yeah. you know.
And trying to do those both in the same day would be difficult.
Yeah, that's right.
Dude, bowfin are really awesome, man. I've seen you post photos of those things. It's like, dude, I don't know why I've never thought to try and chase one. When they're spawning, they get some crazy colors. It's wild.
Yeah. Those males are really colored up. And Jose, I never would have thought about it either, except Danny Scarborough. Again, he's like, you know, I mean, I think Danny was guiding for bowfin even before Blaine Chocolate had, you know, wrote that article. If they were like, there was a bowfin on the cover of Fly Fisherman or something, I think 3 years ago or 2 years ago. It might not have been the cover, but it was like this full spread of a bowfin. And Blaine Chocolate had written an article about it. And I mean, Danny Scarborough was guiding for him before that, you know. Wow. It's just like a species of fish that he could sight fish for in East Texas. And they're laid up super shallow, and you're like, can see them, you know, and you can sight cast to them and kind of do like fish them on the flats kind of. And, you know, they're predators, super strong. It's just like an awesome fish. And yeah, they eat flies, and once you like see how they act, and once you're like in a bowfin spot and you're like looking around and you don't see anything, and then like someone points out to you what to look for, or like what you've been scanning over is actually a bowfin, and you see it for the first time, you're like, yeah, this is super fun. Like, you can, like, you know, then you start seeing bowfin everywhere, you know, and you're like, that's not a log, or that's not a lily pad. That's a bowfin head sticking out under. I mean, I've paddled by a weed flat and like gone by the weed flat, turned around over my shoulder, looked back behind me, and I see a bowfin head come like sneaking out from under this weed flat. And it's just standing or just like finning there looking at us. Wow. And so, you know, we just like turned around and cast it to it. But they're just a super cool fish. They're just really bizarre. And I mean, some of it's, you know, like good casting matters and all that stuff. But a lot of it too is just like that short game. That's really, in a lot of cases, it's a lot harder than you'd imagine. You know, it's like plunking a fly just right next to you as quickly as you can without really thinking about it. And, you know, it's interesting. It's just like a really interesting way of fishing.
I've only seen bowfin once, and it was at the Delta Rivers Nature Center in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Jose's actually been out there, and we're out walking trails. Not me and Jose, me and a friend were out walking trails at the Nature Center, and I saw some bowfin over there with some, and it looked like they were surrounded by a bunch of fry. And I was like, the only time I've ever seen them. And I was like, I want to catch one so freaking bad. And
like a ball of fry that they
dude, it's nuts. It's like millions of them. It's like this cloud that just orbs around them. It's freaking insane.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll swim through the middle of it and they'll like part and then they'll come back together. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool to see. But I know that they're out there. I mean, hell, Bayou Bartholomew goes through Pine Bluff. And so that's, you know, one of the largest, I think one of the largest bayous in the nation. And so I want to go fish it, but every time I'm in Pine Bluff, I'm there for work. And it's like, and it's close enough to home where I don't really stay overnight. So it's not like I get off work and go fishing, but I need to make a trip over there sometime and go and try to target those. And there's this area of the bayou that goes right off of the highway. And there's an access point where I see I can get to it, especially if I can get like a kayak on the water. And dude, I can guarantee that there's probably at least 10 species in that one little area I could probably catch.
That's nuts. Yeah, I've never seen one, but man, that's after seeing Rob's post, like I'm adding it to the list. I got to scratch that one off at some point, but it sounds like it'd be really good practice too for like a coastal fishing, like redfish and black drum and stuff like that. Right. Side casting and the short game is huge, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, what originally got Danny into is just these like it was a coastal-esque thing to do, not on the coast, you know.
Yeah.
Carp are kind of like that too, I feel like, in a lot of ways. Uh-huh,
yeah.
And I don't know if it's Danny's account. There's an account I follow on Instagram. They'll post videos of them like side casting these bowfin, and it's so crazy, man, like how snaky they really are, and like they kind of act like, and but how aggressive they can be. It's pretty cool, man. They put some cool stuff out there. It's wild.
Oh yeah. Yeah. When you see them swim for the first time too, that's another just wild thing with that whole big undulating fin that they have. And then I remember I hooked one time and I remember like watching it and it almost like quivered and like shook like a dog kind of underwater, and it just sunk itself into the mud. I don't know, like a foot down, and I could not pull it out. And then really? It was still moving. It was still like moving under the mud. Like they had a tunnel or something under there. What? And I mean, it broke me off, but it was like, it shook, like disappeared into the sediment of the lake, and then was still running, and I couldn't even see it anymore. And it was just, I just was like, I'm going to break this thing off. There's no way I can stop it. And just, that's what happened. It just kept going and going and going and broke off.
That's crazy.
It just disappeared. Yeah. They're really cool fish.
So
I definitely need to get one.
Yeah. See, so in writing this book, I imagine you're introduced like to a lot of things maybe you hadn't thought of or experienced before. Was there anything that you found like really surprising, like any takeaways or anything like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, man, for sure. The urban stuff, like how much fun and how diverse the urban fishery was. Mm. I mean, yeah, you know, it's whenever you leave Houston and it's the weekend and you got some, you know, your weekend adventures await, I was escaping the city. You know, I was trying to drive out of the city, even if it was just for a day trip, go up to Sam Houston National Forest or, you know, just get out of that whole area. And I knew that people were catching fish and, you know, big fish down in the city, but I was always thinking, I don't want to stay down here. I want to get out. I want to relax a little bit in nature. But then whenever I started getting more into the urban stuff and then knowing that I had to write the book, you know, I was like, okay, I really had better start figuring some of these urban fisheries out. That's what surprised me, was just how much fun they really were. I didn't really give them a fair shake when I was originally.
Interesting. So I guess that begs the question now. So if you had to choose between urban fishing in Houston and the Sam, which one would you tend to gravitate towards?
I'd still have to go up and grab my two-way rod and go catch long ears. I know, it sounds so silly, but it's like, that's just what I love, man. I just love walking around the next bend and you see a wood duck take off the creek and you know, there's like otter tracks on the sandbar and coon tracks on the sandbar, and you know, there'll be like a deer up on the cut bank, and you know, you hear pileated woodpeckers flying over, barred owls, and you're just catching spotted bass and long ear, and you're just not seeing anybody, and you're just walking in the water for miles, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's not the it's catching 4-inch fish all day long.
But I would say that I'd probably agree with that, that yeah. I would much rather be out in wilderness and not around people.
You know, I, after having fished the Sam, I think if I had to choose between the two, I would tend to agree. And I know it sounds kind of odd, but it really is a special place. And I think until until you've had the chance to experience it, you know, you might think we're crazy, but for those who have, I think they look at it differently now. I know I do. But yeah, man, I mean, there's just something cool about hiking in where there's like, literally, you may not see another person ever. And
yeah.
It's pretty neat, man. I enjoyed it a lot. Super cool.
Yeah. Or, you know, and now even if you do see it, someone else, cause you know, they read the book or whatever, they're likely to be a like-minded person, mm-hmm. where, you know, you're likely to strike up a new friendship with someone that huffed it in there and, you know, is wading in the water, jumping over copperheads and stuff just to catch some long-ear sunfish. You know, it's like you're likely to strike up a friendship.
Right. So we keep talking about the two books that you've already written. Are there any other books that you have in the works or any ideas you have?
Oh, no, not right now, for sure. It's just, I'm like, yeah, I mean, we were just talking about it with kids. It's just,
yeah,
all consuming right now. I can't even think about it.
Have you ever considered like a hunting book or traveling?
No, cause I feel like I don't think so. Just cause I'm not nearly as good, hunter, and it's especially not a trapper, you know? Yeah. I mean, there's guys out there that catch, you know, 500 muskrats a year kind of thing, or 1,000 coon a year, you know, like that's because they have to eat, like that's what they do to make money in the wintertime. Like they're that hardcore, you know, they're like, tree trimmers in the summer and fall, or, you know, and then in the wintertime when they don't have work to do, it's like they're trapping, you know, and that's how they put food on the table during that time. So those are the guys that are super hardcore, that anything I would write wouldn't compare to like an hour long conversation with a guy like that, you know.
Kind of one of those things where you kind of feel like you should leave it to the professionals. Kids will definitely take the time away from anything that you thought you had going on. And I can't even imagine trying to write. Like, I'm not a writer in general. Like, hell, I'm surprised if I can write my name half the time. So I just have an issue with getting something from my mind to a paper or a keyboard.
Yeah.
But anytime I try to focus on anything and my kids are around, like, there's a nope. It's either kids are interrupting my train of thought, or my energy wants to go into my kids. And so it's like, there's no way I would ever be able to write anything if my kids are around. So I definitely know how that goes.
Yeah. I was very glad that the writing process for me was pretty much done before my kid was born. That was just good timing.
right. And so the Fly Fishing Houston Southeastern Texas book was part of a series, right? So there was the Austin one, and it's a four book series, right?
So what's out now is just the two. Mm-hmm. Fly Fishing Dallas is coming out really soon. There was going to be a San Antonio book. That's now not going to happen, but there's others that are lined up in the works. I think there's like Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh,
warm
wow.
water. A warm water specific Louisville, Kentucky one. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it's Kentucky somewhere.
Yeah.
As far as I know, Bart Lombardo, who runs panfishonthefly.com, he's writing a panfish specific book that's not a guidebook, but more of like a how-to for panfish.
Oh, that's awesome. I see.
I'm going to have to look out for that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know. I'm super excited about that one. I hope it's still happening. But yeah, I think I've been really excited about that one, because the only other really good panfish centric book that I've found is that Jack Ellis book called The Sunfishes. Mm-hmm. It's out of print now, but you can still find it on Better World Books and stuff like that. Half price books. Yeah, it's called Jack. It's by Jack Ellis. It's called Sunfishes. And he was a guy that moved from like the Sierras in California, moved to East Texas, was like, oh man, I'm never going to fish. And it was the same thing where he started catching panfish. And then he was like, oh, this is awesome. and he became like a real big, like bluegill guy, where he would just go hunt for gigantic bluegill. He did it out of a belly boat. You know, he's got patterns that he has found that are like just killer on bluegill, especially lake bluegill. You know, he's gone into like in depth into hatches, like the crane fly hatch, finding where like mud wasps have built nests. Mm-hmm. And then like finding that a lot of times there are big bluegill that hang out under wasp nests.
Really?
Waiting for larva or like, you know, the adult wasps to come in, and, you know, possibly fall in the water or whatever. So it's super in depth. It's way more in depth than you could ever imagine like a bluegill book would be. But, anyway, oh yeah. Well, I am excited about Bartlett Bar, but then there's that, Terry and Roxanne Wilson wrote that, the Bluegill Diaries book. That's another good panfish book. I said there was, only one other, but there's another one too. So now there'll be three good bluegill/panfish books.
Nice.
I'm hoping Bartlett Bar has still got his on the table.
Yeah.
That'll
be freaking awesome.
We just need Chris Johnson to write a Rio Grande cichlid book.
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah. That or like, quad bass.
We need to spam his inbox. Just all three of us just start sending him messages. He's gonna be there at Iron Flyer, so maybe we can just pop a little worm in his ear and be like, "Hey man, you should try something like that."
he's gonna be at the Aguilane Roundup too.
Man, I wish I could make it to that. That sounds like it's gonna be a blast.
Yeah, it's gonna be a good time. It's only 6 hours, bro. You can come.
I know. I got my kiddo and all that.
You can crash at my place. No big deal, dude.
Man, I wish I could. Next year, I'm going to try to make it a point to go.
You should. So what will you be discussing at the roundup, Rob?
So I'm just going to do basically the fly fishing opportunities in and around the Houston area in terms of freshwater. Mm. Just you know, showcasing the waterways that we have right out the back door. Likely probably go on a super long tangent about the SAM in general and tiny fish and how much fun they are. And then I'm actually part of a Q&A panel with some other people, Captain Stacy from Galveston, the lady who owns Zen Fly Fishing, and so I'll be part of a panel that people can just ask me questions. I feel a little out of place with that, because like all these people that like fly fishing is their job, you know, and I have like a normal day job, you know, and so I'm kind of like, yeah, I just wrote some books, but I still work my 9-to-5.
Don't sell yourself short, man.
But it'll be
great.
Good
book.
It'll be good.
Oh yeah, it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. It's gonna be a good event. There's gonna be a lot of cool people there and really knowledgeable people there. There's gonna be some awesome presentations, awesome fly tires, food. I mean, it's gonna be awesome.
yeah, I'm excited.
Dude, it's gonna be
cool. Are y'all both going to the after party?
I will not.
Oh yeah. You're not going to be there, Jose?
I wish I could, but my girlfriend is having her birthday party that day.
Oh, gotcha.
So, she'd probably kill me if I didn't go, even though we already celebrated. so we'll see. Maybe I can I can convince her to not be so mad if I show up a little bit late.
Why don't you say, hey, yeah, come with me. This is going to be a party as it is.
I thought about that, but her friends have already like planned this whole shindig. And so it's just like, I can't. And she told me, she's like, you don't have to go, but I know that that's like key for you should probably go. So,
right.
So I'm going to try to go if I can. We'll see. There's a very good chance I will not, but you are going to be there, right? Okay. Rob? You said,
yeah, I was planning on it.
Nice.
I was planning on it. So, hopefully I can convince you.
Sounds good. But yeah, so I just have two questions left for you, Rob. One is about the book. I don't know if you've answered this question in other podcasts or not, but it's just something that I've been thinking about because a lot of people are really like against quote unquote spot burning. Did you meet any like resistance or like did you get any complaints or anything when you were writing this book or during your research for this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I didn't, not from the people that mattered, in my opinion, in fact, it was incredible about how willing and how generous people were with their time and their knowledge. You know, it was like people like Danny Scarborough, you know, Jack Boyd, Stavros, Joe Mills, like all these guys, if you look them up on Instagram or whatever, they catch fish in and around the Houston area all the time. Big fish, like cool species, all this stuff, but they're all part of the same community. And, you know, guys like Danny Scarborough, especially who guides these spots, you know, he was the first guy to just be like, oh yeah, absolutely. Like, let me, you know, I didn't really know anything about bowfin. He was like, oh, you're writing a book? Yeah, sure. This is everything I know about bowfin. Let's go, you know, I'll take you out. I'll show you what I mean. All this stuff, you know, I mean, I gone out fishing with him multiple times for bowfin. You know, and it was just one of those things that to me, like having the willingness that he had to share his knowledge and information was like, that's to me, that was way more impactful and important than anybody who has said anything, you know, in a forum or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who just was like, oh, he ruined my long ear spot. I'm just kidding. No one would say that, but you know what I mean? Yeah. It was just like guys like that to be that willing and, to be that generous with their knowledge and time was like, to me, that's what the community is about. You know, that's what the fly anglers in the Houston area are about. You know, the carp are always going to be there in Braze Bayou.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you sting them in the face with a hook, they're still there and they'll still eat the fly tomorrow. You know what I mean? It's not like you're not ruining a fishery. You know, if you were going there and, you know, if you were going up to the East Fork of the San Jacinto and ripping every spot of bass out of there, you know, and frying it up on the bank, well then, yeah, you'd hurt the fishery, but fly anglers aren't doing that. You know, they're not, that's not the people that are buying the book.
Yeah.
So
see, and that's one thing that I've like tried to explain to my friends that are conventional fishermen, that the fly community itself seems to be a lot more of a tight knit community and more willing to help one another. So there's been numerous times that, you know, obviously spot burning's a thing in both communities. Like nobody wants to just say, hey, everybody come to my spot and ruin it, you know, but I feel like fly anglers are more likely to share their ideas and share their thoughts and share their spots and share what they use, share the technique, than a typical conventional angler or a typical bass angler. It's like, no, that's my honey hole. That's where I know that they're at and they're always going to be there. I ain't telling nobody that. Like somebody will ask me and I'll tell them a different spot that I don't go to. And I feel like the fly fishing community is the opposite of that. They're like, oh dude, like if you want to get on this, go here, throw this time of year. Like, dude, you're going to love it. And I don't think I've ever met resistance from asking somebody, dude, like where's that at? Or like, or not even asking for a spot, but like, how did you catch that? And they're just willing to give the information.
Yeah, exactly. And then, but at the same time too, you know that they're going to go there and they're going to treat it with respect. Mm-hmm. And when they leave, they'll probably pick up trash on their way out. Right. You know what I mean? Like, they'll probably make it a better place when they leave there. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the kicker of the whole thing with the fly angling community. And, mm-hmm. and the guidebook was like, okay, these are our shared waterways, whether or not you ever step foot in them. The more people that do, if they're, you know, if they're fly anglers and they're like-minded fly anglers, they're, you know, the next time someone is like dumping tires into the creek, well, they're probably going to call it in to the state environmental agency, mm-hmm. and say, like, there's a bunch of tires that somebody dumped in the creek in my white bass creek, you know? Yeah. So it's, I think that the more fly anglers that are out there means that they're promoting the waterways more, mm-hmm. and they'll actually like help them out in the long run. I mean, you see it with Chris Johnson, you know, and Brushy Creek and stuff like that. I mean, like, all those people that fish that creek love that creek, and, you know, they've stopped things like wastewater treatment plants that weren't working properly, mm-hmm. and that were like actually dumping sewage, you know, not completely filtering out the water correctly. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. they are the ones that called that in and said, there's something wrong with this wastewater treatment plant. Would you guys fix it? And then they did, you know.
Exactly. And that was a whole debacle. It's crazy to think, yeah. how many PPMs of waste were in that waterway, and it was a known issue at the wastewater plant, and they, yeah. just turned a blind eye to it. Like, freaking crazy.
Yeah. And, but they, you know, they took fly anglers to hold them accountable, mm-hmm. to, yep. say, this is not acceptable,
which is awesome.
Yeah.
We kind of got off on a tangent, yeah. I guess. So what was your second question? I'd say,
oh yeah. Yeah. Well, that was a long, well, long answer. Sorry.
I kind of forgot now, because that was pretty interesting. shoot, man. I don't know. Let's do something that gets a bit more lighthearted. Rob, if someone handed you a plane ticket that you can go anywhere in the world to fish for anything you wanted to, what is the, where would you like to go and what would you like to fish for?
I'd go to South America.
Yeah.
I'd go to South America. Yeah. Fish. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be Dorado or peacock bass or just, mm-hmm. some, you know, some like monstrous predatory fish that you can strip flies in, right. the face.
Dude, golden Dorado is high on my list. Those fish are freaking epic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and just, you know, strip setting on massive fish like that in a creek where, you know, it's like a smallmouth river, but, yeah. then there's these, like, you know, gigantic fish in them. Yeah. I think that would be on my,
well, Rob,
tie on my list.
I got a buddy in Argentina. Might be able to work something out.
All right. Dude, I would consider it for sure.
I can hear the gears. He's like, my wife, my son. How am I going to pitch it to them?
How old does he have to be for me to leave for a month?
I think he's done some research, if not on Dorado, on like fish in general in one of the river systems in Argentina. So he would probably know. He's not a guide or anything, but he likes to fish. So he would at least be able to point, cool. us in the right direction. And then I have my former advisor is actually from Bolivia, so I'm sure he would probably know some, okay. people who. So it's possible. So maybe we can plan a little trip, and Russ, me, and you, Rob, go and try and catch some Dorados.
Yeah, dude, that'd be awesome. Be freaking awesome. So kind of in the same so vein cool. of that, have y'all seen John B's latest video that came out of him in the on the Amazon?
I have, last night, actually.
No.
Dude. Those freaking wolf fish and payara they were catching is freaking, dude. Insane. Could you imagine trying to get one of those on the fly?
Wolf fish remind me of like a South American bowfin.
Those, yeah. are, yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they're built very similarly. Like, it's wild. But those things are crazy.
Dude, they are. And it's crazy how much power they had. Like, you see them using these freaking like heavy action conventional gear, and it's just freaking double them over, pulling, like, you see the boat moving and everything, and it's, you know, a 15-20 pound wolf fish just pulling them around. I was like, god, dude, that'd be freaking awesome.
Oh, I had to look that up. I didn't Yeah, I can totally see what you're talking about with bowfin.
Yeah, it's they look like a South American cousin of bowfin. It's crazy.
Dude, there's some gnarly fish.
Dude, what about some arapaima? That would be...
Dude, I'd love to catch an arapaima.
Dude, yeah.
Arapaima, payara, or a freaking goonch catfish, dude. Could you imagine catching a huge catfish with massive teeth?
Yeah.
That would be freaking awesome.
What if they'd eat a streamer? That'd be crazy.
Well, they typically live in muddy water, so they would have to be up shallow to even be able to see it, I would think. Just but, black I mean, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, but I think it would be quite difficult.
If they got teeth on them, I mean, you know, they probably eat anything that fits in their mouth.
Right.
I mean, you know, shoot some of like the most vicious takes ever. You're just like, what is this thing? And then it's a channel cat.
Yeah.
But it just like pounds the fly.
I think I was with you when that happened one time. I was like, what the heck? Like my rod, my little 3 was bent over. It was a little like 12 inch channel cat.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were fishing the West Fork and my buddy caught a blue cat that, I think it weighed 8 pounds. Jeez. And it was a serious fight. Yeah, it was a serious fight. And he caught on a 5 weight.
I remember the first catfish I caught on the fly rod was actually at a retention pond in Richmond, Rosenberg area. And I was just stripping a little olive woolly bugger on my 2 weight glass rod. And I, you know, something took and I strip set and I'm like, the hell is this? This is peel and drag, rock doubled over. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? It was a little freaking probably foot long channel cat missing a fin. And that was a fight.
Yeah.
Dude, on the same subject, you know, a Wells catfish on the fly would be pretty epic too. Those things lures. Those things are gnarly, man. And they get
those things don't even look like their head looks like a catfish, but their body's like a freaking eel. Like, dude, they're weird looking.
Yeah.
But have you seen those takes? Looking. Like, there's a dude on YouTube, I don't know, but he was fishing with like a big topwater and he like figure aided this Wells. And I mean, massive explosion. It was like a 4 foot long fish at least. I mean, it was just insane.
You talking about the guy in the float tube?
Yeah. That dude.
Yeah. Dude, that would be freaking nuts.
If I can find the video, I'll send it to you, Rob, but it's crazy. That thing on the fly would be awesome.
Oh yeah. That's something like that would be super cool.
Dude, there's so many fish out there that I'd just love to catch. Like, no, or like a freaking, what's that other one? Goliath tiger fish.
Oh,
dude, that would be an awesome fish. Those fish are so damn aggressive. I don't know. Maybe I'm leaning more towards like big toothy fish. That's what it sounds like.
Sounds like you want to go to South America.
Yeah.
Right. South America or somewhere tropical with some barracuda or something. Dude, I've casted some meat, like big, like 8 inch flies at freaking 8 foot alligator gar in Louisiana. And they just don't even freaking care. Like just dinosaurs cruising right next to the boat, 5 feet away from you. And you just slam it on the water right next to them. And they don't even, it doesn't faze them. They're like, if it ain't bleeding, I don't want it. But I think that would be so much fun to fight something like that on a fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be.
Yeah. The gator gar that I've messed with were the same way. It was like, you throw something at them, don't care at all. And then the day that they do care, it's like, hang on, you know, like you just completely out of the blue, stripping like a fly in front of them. And not, you know, not expecting them to eat at all. And then all of a sudden they just move their head and suck in the fly.
Really? So see, cool. I've never hooked a gator gar, but I've hooked some spotted and some long nose. And I've never been able to land one, but I've hooked quite a few.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never hooked a gator gar. I've hooked a bunch of spotted gar and I can't land them, man. They always put the hook. I get a really bad hook set or I don't know what the deal is, but
yeah. Or just gar being gar, you know, it's just, nature of the beast with them.
Yeah. And that's one that I know people will use like rope flies and stuff, but I don't like that idea because if it snaps your line, whatever, that's like a dead sentence for that fish.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if you do bring them to hand, you got to like spend the time to open their mouth, pry it open, pull the rope out and it's, or cut it out or whatever. And you got to make sure you cut all the strands out or their mouth's going to get sealed shut again. It's to me, it's much better to hook them convention or like with a hook, play them until they either spit the hook or you're lucky enough to bring them in and then you don't have to worry about it. But man, I keep leather gloves in my backpack for like any time that happens. I just had to put them on last weekend because I caught a long nose and I was like bringing them in one handed, like rooting around in my backpack with the other hand, pulling my leather gloves on. And then you can just grab them right by the face with your leather gloves and you don't get all chewed up, you know, and
that's,
you can just pop the hook out that way.
That's a good tip.
Let them go.
So yeah, that's a real good tip. So I know we're running pretty long on time and hopefully we're not keeping you too long, Rob.
Oh yeah.
Just one more question for those who are wanting to go fish the sand. What are some tips that you would recommend for someone who has not done it to probably take, at least take into consideration?
Oh, I would say if you're going to fish the sand, I would say start with the bigger waterways. And when I say bigger, I'm doing air quotes because, you know, some of those even smaller tributaries, you know, they're finicky, they're intermittent flows, you know, a lot of them will, the flow rates will like diminish and there's just pools and you have to like walk down and find the pools where the fish have oversummered in the pools. But so if you would go and stay to like the East Fork or Winter's Bayou, and do ultralight tackle, you know, three weight and under kind of thing, and bring size 8 to 10, mini streamers or nymphs. If you're going in the summer or spring, do the dry dropper method with them because I found that that works really well in those areas. I mean, and when I say dry dropper, it could be hopper dropper too, you know, anything to like a Lano bug up on top and then like a small sand jack or something like that underneath, or, you know, any kind of like Prince nymph, something like that. That seems to work really well. But you know, you don't want to make your dropper too long, like probably 2 feet's probably too long for a lot of these waterways. It's like a foot max kind of thing. It's just something subsurface.
Nice.
And just don't be afraid to walk. You have to do a lot of walking.
We're good shoes.
But the further you walk in. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Didn't you have a blowout one time, Jose?
Oh yeah.
Blowout on both of them.
He was like not wearing shoes by the end of the trip. It was just like completely blown out. Both toes were sticking out of the side.
Oh, good time.
Oh, I forgot about that. That was hilarious.
Yeah, but your shoes are yelling at you. They're like, come on, get us out of this damn forest already.
Yeah, we had like a half mile or 3/4 mile walk back. And I was like, dude, I don't know how my soles are literally falling off. Like, so I had to undo like the top half of my laces and then wrap it around and sit and like knot it so it wouldn't fall off. Made it back to the truck okay, but it was pretty rough.
Man, thanks for reminding me of that. I completely forgot about that. That was so funny.
Yeah, no, I think you took a picture, if I wasn't mistaken.
Yeah, I did. I did, because it was a riot.
Yeah, it was some cheap way. Actually, they weren't cheap. They were like $70, but they were on sale, so I got them for like $20. But they did not last.
Now you know why they were.
Yeah, I guess it was not good. So yeah, just bring some good shoes in addition to what Rob said.
Yeah,
that's freaking awesome. So yeah, he said a hopper dropper with a sand jack. See how he plugged that? So I'll put the description for his YouTube video for the sand jack squirrel in there so y'all can actually look at that.
Thanks, man.
So of course, any closing remarks, Rob?
Thanks guys, thanks for having me on. This was really fun. Russell's nice meeting you, and it's nice to know you're in Arkansas. It'll be fun to maybe someday get back up there and fish in your neck of the woods.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you're up here, plan on coming up here, want to come up here, let me know. I'll do my best to you know, guide you around. If you need a place to stay, you got a place to stay here, and you're always welcome, man. And it was nice meeting you as well.
Yeah. And Jose, I'll see you this weekend.
Yes, sir. Sounds good.
Looking forward to that.
Thanks for taking the time and joining us, man. Always a good time chatting with you. And, yeah, next time I'm heading to Arkansas, I'll shoot you a message, see if you're able to take along or not. And,
all right, man.
And would you like to plug your books?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks. Fly Fishing Houston in Southeastern Texas. That is out now. You can pick it up anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it off my website, flyfishingthesam.com. You can get it at Gordian Sons if you live in Houston. You can get it at Orvis Houston. Check them out if you need to pick up some flies or rods or anything, you can pick up a book there. You can pick up Fly Fishing the Sam as well at Gordian Sons. And need to contact me for any reason, just go to flyfishingthesam.com and you can go to the bottom of the homepage there and there's a little contact sheet. So just, you know, you can fill that out. If you got any questions for me, if you want to yell at me about something, whatever, you can contact me through there.
Awesome. Thanks, Rob. It was a blast having you, man. And look forward to catching up.
Yeah. Thank you guys. Yeah. Yeah. Looking forward to it. I appreciate it, guys.
Yes, sir. Take care. And for those of you listeners, thank you for listening to the end. And if there's any questions you have for me or Jose or Rob, then feel free to hit us up on our socials. We'll put all the links in the description. So thank you all for listening to the end, and we'll catch y'all next time.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.